Chapter 10. News from Yalta. At the time the disaster befell Nikanor Ivanovich, the office of the Variety's financial director, Rimsky, not far from number 302B on the Sadovaya, contained two people, Rimsky himself and the Variety's manager, Varyonika. Two windows of the large office, located on the second floor of the theatre, opened on Sadovaya. A third, right behind the financial director's back as he sat at his desk, overlooked the Variety's summer garden, complete with refreshment stands, a shooting gallery, and an open stage. Apart from the desk, the office decor consisted of several old posters hanging on the walls, a small table with a carafe of water, four armchairs, and a stand in the corner displaying an old, dusty model of some stage set. Finally, it goes without saying that the office had a small, beat-up, peeling fireproof safe, which stood to Rimsky's left near the desk. Rimsky, sitting at this desk, had been in the worst of spirits since the morning started, while Varyonika, by contrast, was very lively and somehow unusually anxious and active. At the same time, he had no outlet for his energy. Varyonika was hiding in the financial director's office from the free ticket hounds who poisoned his existence, particularly on opening days. And today was precisely such a day. Whenever the phone rang, Varyonika picked up the receiver and lied into it.
"Who? Varyonika? He's not in. Stepped out of the theatre."
"Would you please call Likoliev again?" Rimsky asked irritably.
"He's not home, OK? I already sent Karpov to check. No one in the apartment."
"Hell knows what's going on," Rimsky hissed, clicking on the adding machine.
The door opened, and an usher dragged in a thick stack of freshly printed supplementary posters. On the green sheets, large red letters spelled out, "Today, and every day at the Variety Theatre, in addition to the regular programme, Professor Volant. Seances of black magic, followed by its complete exposure." Stepping away and admiring the poster, which he had thrown over the model, Varyonika immediately ordered the usher to send all copies to be posted.
"Nice and striking,"
Varyonika noted once the usher left.
"Well, I don't like this Herald scheme in the least," Rimsky grumbled,
glancing spitefully at the poster through his horn-rimmed glasses.
"I'm surprised they even let him put this on."
"Now, don't be hasty, Grigory Danilovich. It's a very subtle move. The whole point is the exposure."
"I don't know. I don't know. There is no point. He always cooks up things like this. He should have shown me the magician at least. If you've seen him, hell knows where he dug him up."
It turned out that Varyonika, just like Rimsky, had not seen the magician. Yesterday, Stiopa ran to the financial director, like a madman, according to Rimsky, with the draft of the contract already prepared, immediately had the contract rewritten and the money issued, and the magician gave them the slip, and no one had seen him but Stiopa himself. Rimsky took out his watch, saw that it read 2:05, and became absolutely livid. Really now, Likhodiev had called around 11, said that he'd be there in half an hour, and then not only did he not show up, but he also disappeared from his apartment. "My work's being held up here," Rimsky growled, jabbing a finger at a pile of unsigned papers.
"I almost wonder if he fell under a tram like Berlioz,"
Varyonika said, holding the receiver to his ear and hearing only low, long and utterly hopeless tones.
"Now that would be nice," Rimsky said barely audibly through his teeth.
Just then, a woman walked into the office, wearing a uniform jacket, a visor cap, a black skirt and trainers. She extracted a small white square and a notebook from the small pouch on her belt and asked,
"Where's Variety Superspeed Telegram for you? Sign here."
Varyonika scribbled something in the woman's notebook, and as soon as the door slammed shut behind her, he opened the square. Having read the telegram, he blinked a few times and handed the square to Rimsky. The telegram contained the following. "Yalta to Moscow, Variety. Today, 11:30, brown-haired man, psychiatric case, dressed nightshirt, trousers, no boots, arrived police station, calling self Likhodiev, Variety director. Wire Yalta, criminal investigator, where director Likhodiev.
Well, I'll be, Rimsky exclaimed, and added, another surprise.
A false Dmitri,
Varyonika said, and began to talk into the receiver.
Telegraph, varieties count. Please accept a superspeed. Ready? Yalta, criminal investigator, director Likodiev in Moscow, financial director Rimsky.
Regardless of the news of the Yalta imposter, Varyonika began once more to seek out Stiopa by phone everywhere, and naturally did not find him anywhere. Receiver in hand, Varyonika was wondering who else he could call when the same woman who brought the first wire walked in and handed him a new envelope. Opening it hurriedly, Varyonika read the print and whistled.
Now what? Rimsky asked, twitching nervously.
Varyonika handed him the telegram silently, and the financial director saw the words. Please believe thrown Yalta Volant Hypnosis. Wire criminal investigator, identity verification, Likodiev.
Their heads touching, Rimsky and Varyonika reread the telegram. Having reread it, they stared at each other silently.
Gentlemen! The woman exploded suddenly. How about you sign first, and then be silent all you want? I have super speeds to deliver.
Without taking his eyes off the telegram, Varyonika scribbled a crooked signature in the notebook, and the woman disappeared.
You spoke to him a little after 11 on the phone, right?
The manager began in utter confusion.
It's ludicrous, Rimsky cried piercingly. Whether I talk to him or not, he couldn't be in Yalta now. It's ludicrous.
He's drunk,
Varyonika said.
Who's drunk?
Rimsky asked, and again they stared at each other. There could be no doubt that whoever was sending the telegrams from Yalta was either an imposter or a lunatic. But here was the oddity. How did the mystery man from Yalta know about Volant, who had only arrived in Moscow yesterday? How did he know of the connection between Likodiev and Volant?
Hypnosis.
Varyonika repeated the word from the telegram.
How does he know about Volant?
He blinked and then exclaimed decisively,
No, it's rubbish, rubbish, rubbish.
Where's this Volant staying, devil take him?
Rimsky asked. Varyonika got in touch with the Travellers' Bureau immediately and, to Rimsky's complete surprise, announced that Volant was staying in Likodiev's apartment. Dialing the number of Likodiev's place, Varyonika listened to the dense signal from the receiver for a long time. Amid the rings, a grim, heavy voice could be heard singing,
Cliffs, my refuge.
And Varyonika decided that the telephone line was getting interference from a radio station.
No answer at the apartment, Varyonika said, hanging up. Could try again, I suppose.
He did not finish. The very same woman appeared in the doors. As both Rimsky and Varyonika rose to meet her, she pulled a dark sheet out of her bag instead of the usual white one.
This is beginning to get interesting.
Varyonika squeezed through his teeth, following the hastily departing woman with his gaze. Rimsky took possession of the sheet first. Handwritten black lines stood out clearly against the dark background of the photographic paper. Proof my handwriting and signature. Wire confirmation set up secret observation Volant, Likodiev. Over 20 years of theatre work, Varyonika had seen it all. But now he felt as if a shroud had descended over his mind. He could not manage anything apart from the trite and completely absurd phrase,
This can't be.
Rimsky acted differently. He got up, opened the door, and barked at the messenger girl sitting outside on a stool.
Don't let anyone in but postal workers.
And locked the office with his key. Then he took out a stack of paper from his desk and began to meticulously compare the thick left-slanting letters in the photogram to letters from Stiopa's memoranda containing his signatures adorned with a swirling flourish. Leaning his entire body on the table, Varyonika breathed fiercely in Rimsky's cheek.
It's his handwriting, the financial director said firmly at last, and Varyonika echoed,
His.
Looking deep into Rimsky's face, the manager was amazed at the change that occurred. The already lean financial director seemed to grow leaner still,
and even older.
The eyes in the horn-rimmed frames lost their usual prickliness and acquired not only anxiety, but even a sort of despondency. Valionika went through everything befitting a man in a moment of great astonishment. He ran about the office, twice raised his hands as though crucified, drank an entire glass of yellowish water from the carafe, and kept exclaiming, "I don't understand, I do not understand." Meanwhile, Rimsky was looking out the window and thinking tensely about something. The financial director's position was very difficult. At once, without leaving the spot, he would need to invent ordinary explanations for extraordinary events. Narrowing his eyes, the financial director imagined Stiopa boarding some sort of incredible super-fast airplane in his nightshirt and without boots at about 11:30. And then again, Stiopa, also at 11:30, already standing in his socks on an airfield in Yalta. Hell knew what this was. Perhaps it was not Stiopa who had called him from the apartment. No, it was Stiopa. Who but Rimsky should know Stiopa's voice? And even if it hadn't been Stiopa today, it certainly had been Stiopa no earlier than last night, when the man came to this very office with his idiotic contract, annoying the financial director with his thoughtlessness. How could he have left or flown away without notifying the theatre? And even if he had left last night, he would not have gotten there by noon today. Or would he? "How far to Yalta?" Rimsky asked. Varionika stopped running around and shouted, Thought of that already. It's about 1,500 kilometres to Sevastopol by railroad. Add about 800 more for Yalta, less by air, of course.
Right. Trains were out of the question.
But what then? A fighter plane? Who would let Stiopa into a fighter plane without boots? Why, perhaps he took off his boots upon arriving at Yalta. Again, why? Besides, they would not let him in a fighter plane in boots either. And the fighter plane's got nothing to do with it. After all, it's written right here that he came to the police station at 11:30, while the telephone conversation in Moscow took place at...
Excuse me.
The dial of Rimsky's watch appeared before his eyes. He recalled where the arrows had been. Oh, horror. It had been 11:20. So what does this come out to? If one assumed that immediately following the conversation, Stiopa dashed to the airfield and reached it in, say, 5 minutes, which, by the way, is equally unthinkable, then it turns out that the airplane, taking off instantly, covered over 1,000 kilometres in 5 minutes. Therefore, in an hour, it can cover over 12,000 kilometres. This cannot be. And therefore, Stiopa cannot be in Yalta. What remains? Hypnosis? There is no hypnosis on earth that can toss a man 1,000 kilometres away. Or is he only imagining himself in Yalta? Perhaps he is, but then is Yalta's criminal investigator imagining it as well? No, forgive me, but such things do not happen. And yet, aren't the telegrams coming from there? The financial director's face was literally frightening. Meanwhile, the doorknob outside was being twisted and jerked to the messenger girl's frantic screaming. "No way! I'm not letting you in! Cut my throat! I still won't! Urgent meeting!" Rimsky composed himself as well as he could, picked up the receiver and said, "Super urgent connection to Yalta, please." "Smart," Varionika exclaimed in his head. But the connection to Yalta did not come. Rimsky hung up and said, "Line is down. Rotten luck." Evidently, the broken line had especially upset him and driven him further into thought. Pondering a while, he picked up the receiver with one hand and began writing down all that he said with the other. "Take a superspeed wire. Variety, yes. Yalta. Criminal investigator, yes. Today, around 11:30, Likhoryev spoke me, telephone, Moscow. Stop. After this, did not come to work. Cannot be located by phone. Stop. Confirming handwriting. Stop. Taking observation measures. Specified artist. Stop. Financial director, Rimsky." "Very smart,"
Larionica thought. But not for long, for another word flashed in his head.
Stupid. He couldn't be in Yalta.
In the meantime, Rimsky did the following. He neatly folded all the telegrams and his own text into a stack, placed the stack in an envelope, sealed it, wrote a few words on it, and handed it to Varyonika, saying, "Take it you-know-where right now, Ivan Savayevich, personally. Let them sort it out."
Now that is truly smart, thought Varyonika, placing the envelope in his briefcase. Then, just in case, he dialed Stiopa's home number one last time, listened carefully, and then began to wink and grimace mysteriously and happily. Rimsky craned his neck. "Could I speak to the artist Volant, please?"
Varyonika asked sweetly.
"They're busy," came a rattling voice from the receiver. "Who is this?"
"Varyonika, manager of the Variety."
"Ivan Savayevich," the receiver cried joyfully. "Terribly pleased to hear your voice. How are you?"
"Merci," said Varyonika in astonishment.
"And who am I speaking to?"
His assistant and interpreter, Kurovyov," the receiver sputtered.
"Completely at your service, my dearest Ivan Savayevich. Direct me as you please, so?"
"Pardon me, but does Stefan Bogdanovich Likhodiev happen to be home right now?"
"Alas, no, no," the receiver cried.
"He left." "Where to?"
"For a drive in the country."
"What? A drive? When's he coming back?"
"He just said he'd go for a breath of fresh air and come right back."
"Right,"
Varyonika said, at a loss.
"Merci. If you would be so kind, please tell Monsieur Volant that his performance will be during the third segment today."
"Got it, of course, right away, urgently, unquestionably, we'll relay the message,"
the receiver rapped out in staccato.
"All the best, then,"
Varyonika said, puzzled.
"Please accept," the receiver continued, "my finest, warmest greetings and wishes, success, luck, complete happiness, everything."
"Well, of course I told you,"
the manager yelled excitedly.
"Forget Yalta, he went for a drive in the country."
"Well, if that's true," the financial director began, paling with hatred, "then there are no words to describe what a swine he is." Then the manager leaped in the air and shouted so loud that Rimsky flinched.
"I remember! I remember! They've just opened a Georgian diner in Pushkino, Yalta. It's obvious. He went there, got drunk, and started sending telegrams."
"Well, that's just too much," Rimsky replied, his cheek twitching, sincere and grave hatred burning in his eyes. "Fine, then. He'll pay dearly for this little excursion." Then he stumbled all of a sudden and added hesitantly, "But wait, the criminal investigator."
"That's nonsense, his own little tricks," the effusive manager interrupted and asked, "Shall I take the envelope anyway?"
"Absolutely," Rimsky replied. The door opened again to reveal the same woman. "It's her," Rimsky thought dismally, and they both rose to greet the postwoman. This time, the telegram contained the words, "Thanks. Confirmation. Urgently transfer 500 rubles via criminal investigator. Flying Moscow tomorrow. Likhodiev."
"He's gone mad," Varyonika said weakly.
As for Rimsky, he jingled his key, took the money out of the fireproof safe, counted out 500 rubles, made a phone call, gave the money to a courier, and sent him to the telegraph office.
"Forgive me, Grigory Danilovich," Varyonika said, not believing his eyes. "If you ask me, you shouldn't be sending the money."
"It will be returned," Rimsky replied quietly. "But he will answer in full for this little picnic." And pointing to Varyonika's briefcase, he added, "Go, Ivan Savayevich, don't delay." And Varyonika ran out of the office with his briefcase. He went down to the first floor, saw a very long line by the box office, and found out from the cashier that she expected the show to sell out within the hour.
as people started pouring in the moment they saw the supplementary posters. He ordered the cashier to hold on to 30 of the best seats in the boxes and orchestra, jumped out of the box office, and, fighting off annoying free ticket hounds, dove into his office to grab his cap. Just then the phone rang.
Yes!
Veronica shouted.
Ivan Savyevich?
The receiver inquired in a most repugnant nasal voice.
He's not in the theatre!
Veronica began to yell, but the receiver interrupted immediately.
Don't fool around, Ivan Savyevich, but listen. Don't take the telegrams anywhere and don't show them to anyone.
Who's this?
Veronica roared.
Quit your tricks, mister. We'll straighten you out in a second. What's your number? Veronica,
the same disgusting voice replied.
Do you understand Russian? Do not take the telegrams anywhere.
Oh! So you won't desist? The manager screamed in a rage. Well, you just wait. You'll pay for this.
He yelled some other threat and then fell silent, sensing that no one at the other end was listening anymore. Somehow, the office quickly grew dark. Veronica ran out, slammed the door shut behind him, and headed out to the summer garden through a side door. The manager was excited and brimming with energy. After the insolent phone call, he had no doubt that it was some gang of hooligans out to play a few nasty tricks, and that these tricks were somehow connected to Likhodiev's disappearance. The manager was practically choking with desire to expose the villains, and strange as it sounds, he nursed an anticipation of something pleasant within him. This happens when a man seeks to become the centre of attention, to break some sensational news somewhere. The wind in the garden blew sand in the manager's face, as if blocking his path, as if forewarning him. Somewhere on the second floor, a window pane slammed so hard that the glass almost flew out, and the tops of the maples and lindens rustled alarmingly. It grew darker and fresher. The manager rubbed his eyes and saw a low-hanging, yellow-bellied storm cloud crawling over Moscow. A dense rumble came from the distance. However great Veronica's hurry, an irresistible impulse made him drop by the summer restroom for a second to check whether the electrician had placed a wire mesh over the lamp. Running past the shooting gallery, Veronica came to the dense lilac growth that surrounded the light blue restroom building. The electrician turned out to be a competent man, and the lamp under the roof of the men's section had already been wrapped in metal netting. However, the manager was upset by the fact that, even in the pre-storm dusk, it was possible to see that the walls had already been written on with charcoal and pencil. Oh, what the... The manager began, and then heard a voice behind him purr.
Is that you, Ivan Savyevich?
Veronica gave a start, turned around, and saw a short, fat man standing behind him. The man's face looked oddly feline.
Yeah, it's me,
Veronica replied unpleasantly.
Very, very pleased,
the cat-like fatso replied in a squeaky voice, and taking a sudden swing, he punched Veronica in the ear so hard that the cap flew off the manager's head, disappearing without a trace in the toilet. The fat man's blow caused the entire restroom to light up with shaky light for a moment, and thunder followed from the sky. Another flash came, and a second man appeared before the manager. Short, but with an athletic build, fiery red hair, a fang protruding from his mouth, and a wall eye. This second one was apparently a lefty, for he dealt the manager another one in the left ear. Again, the sky rumbled in response, and a rainstorm came crashing down on the wooden roof of the restroom.
But, comrade,
whispered the flabbergasted manager, immediately realizing that the words comrades was not at all appropriate for bandits attacking a man in a public restroom, he rasped,
Folks!
Figured out that this new title was likewise undeserved, and received a third blow that sent blood gushing from his nose onto his shirt. although he could not tell which of the two it came from.
"What's in the briefcase, parasite?"
the one resembling a cat shouted piercingly.
"Telegrams? And weren't you warned over the phone not to take them anywhere? I'm asking you, weren't you warned?"
"I was warned," the manager replied, gasping.
"And you ran anyway? Hand over the case, vermin!"
The second man cried in the same nasal voice that had spoken earlier from the phone and tore the briefcase out of Veronica's shaking hands. Together, they took the manager under the arms, dragged him out of the garden, and dashed off down Sedovaya. The thunderstorm raged in full force. Rumbling, howling water plummeted through sewer gratings. Waves bubbled and swelled everywhere. Streams poured from roofs, missing the drainpipes, and foaming currents rushed from gateways. All that lived had been washed off Sedovaya, and there was no one left to rescue Ivan Savelyevich. Leaping over the muddy rivers, amid flashes of lightning, the bandits hauled the half-dead manager to number 302B in mere seconds and flew through the gate, where two barefoot women were huddling by the wall, holding their shoes and stockings in their hands. They dashed towards the sixth entrance, and Veronica, now close to madness, was taken up to the fifth landing and thrown down on the floor in Stiopa Likhodiev's familiar hall. Here, both villains vanished, and instead there appeared in the hall a completely naked girl, a redhead with flaming phosphorescent eyes. Veronica realized that this was the most terrible of all that was happening to him and shrank back against the wall, moaning. The girl walked right up to the manager and placed the palms of her hands on his shoulders. Veronica's hair stood on end, for even through the cold, water-soaked fabric of his shirt, he felt her palms to be far colder, as cold as ice itself. "Let me give you a kiss," the girl said tenderly, and her shining eyes appeared right in front of his own. Then Veronica lost consciousness and did not feel the kiss.